listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of Flight Risk by Jeff Wise. One of the objectives of hybrid warfare is to keep an opponent unsure of what is happening or why. Were the DHL attacks an earnest attempt to destroy a cargo plane? A test run to lay the groundwork for a later attack? Or perhaps a feint, a distraction from other more dangerous schemes? There was no way to tell from the physical evidence alone. Unpredictability is the mark of a skilled gray zone operator, and a wide range of tools and styles is an asset. A feature of Russia's alleged campaign of disruption is that it uses different kinds of attacks. Some, like blasting an airliner out of the sky with a missile, are blunt and brutal. Others can be dazzlingly brilliant. Russia's SolarWinds cyber attack, which bored deep into network management software between 2019 and 2020, involved techniques so ingenious that they had previously been deemed impossible. Investigators, Wired later reported, were blown away by the hack's complexity and extreme premeditation. A worst-case scenario is one in which Russia combines the full measure of both its cleverness and its brutality to trigger an aviation catastrophe that leaves hundreds dead with no way to tell for certain who was responsible, or even without any firm evidence that it had been an attack at all. Western authorities have been aware of the danger of a cyber attack against aviation for some time. In 2014, the Federal Aviation Administration enlisted a Washington, D.C. area consulting company to assess the cyber vulnerability of U.S. airliners. The resulting study reported that numerous potential avenues of attack were wide open, from the design and production of aircraft to routine maintenance. It concluded that a significant risk exists across legacy, current, and next new generation aircraft. In the years that followed, cybersecurity specialists, called penetration testers, went to work to identify specific vulnerabilities. One such effort was organized by the Department of Homeland Security in 2016. A unit within the agency, called the Science and Technology Cybersecurity Division, obtained a Boeing 757 and turned it over to a team of pen testers. Within 2 days, they were able to find a way to break into the system remotely. It was later reported that early testing indicates that viable attack vectors exist that could impact flight operations. Private investigators have had similar results. In 2018, Ken Monroe, founder of the British cybersecurity firm Pentest Partners, borrowed a disused 747 and demonstrated potential vulnerabilities in aircraft systems using an unsecured tablet computer. So far, though, efforts to identify and remedy vulnerabilities have been piecemeal and sporadic. Current policies and practices are inadequate to deal with the immediacy and devastating consequences that could result from a catastrophic cyber attack on an airborne commercial aircraft, warned a 2017 DHS report, which also noted a significant reluctance by the commercial world to expend resources to prevent penetration and attack. That reluctance abides today. It's hard to convince the aviation industry that cybersecurity isn't just about protecting computers. New cyber-physical threats, like GPS spoofing and jamming, can also disrupt aircraft operations and safety, says Sampaygadea. Throughout 2024, Russia appeared to dramatically increase suspected gray zone attacks against Europe. There was the alleged assassination of a prominent defector in Spain, and an apparent attempted assassination of several defense industry executives. Agents were suspected of breaking into water treatment plants in Finland and Sweden. Mysterious drones targeted a U.S. airbase in Germany and England, and temporarily shut down an airport in Sweden. Russian ships were suspected of cutting a power cable and two data cables under the Baltic Sea. And this year, a cargo ship under the alleged command of a Russian national plowed into an anchored tanker full of jet fuel for the U.S. military, setting it ablaze. Russian military intelligence is on a sustained mission to generate mayhem on British and European streets, said Ken McCallum, Director General of MI5, in a rare public speech. We've seen arson, sabotage, and more. Dangerous actions conducted with increasing recklessness. The planting of incendiary devices, however, has threatened to take the temperature above a boil. According to the New York Times, U.S. intelligence officials became convinced that the DHL warehouse incidents were part of a larger plan to target planes headed for the United States and Canada. The devices ignited after the planes had landed, but a malfunction could easily trigger a mass casualty event because passenger planes sometimes transport smaller packages in spare cargo space. The risk of catastrophic error was clear, former Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas told The Times in January, just before Donald Trump's inauguration. These could catch fire in a fully loaded aircraft. Alarmed, the Biden White House reportedly sent leading security and intelligence officials to warn the Kremlin of the danger that could result from such a plan, and that the repercussions could be severe. The message got through, apparently, and the attacks stopped, at least for the time being. The security situation in the United States has changed dramatically and quickly. Trump is a longtime admirer of Putin and has said that he trusts Russia more than U.S. intelligence. On January 21st, his second day in power, Trump dismissed members of the Aviation Security Advisory Committee, a group set up in the wake of the Lockerbie bombing to strengthen airline and airport security. In February, his Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth reportedly ordered a halt to offensive cyber operations against Russia. Given the new pro-Kremlin tilt, America's closest intelligence allies are reportedly reconsidering whether to continue sharing secrets with U.S. intelligence. People are very worried, an unnamed former U.S. intelligence official told NBC. The challenge in a hybrid warfare environment isn't to identify and deal with each attack that comes your way. It's to recognize that you're in a hostile environment and that your adversary is constantly thinking of new ways to do harm. To that end, researchers in the field of aviation cybersecurity are constantly working to identify potential weaknesses and figure out how they could be exploited so that defenses can be erected. One system that's received particular attention is the Traffic Collision Avoidance System, or TCAS, which was designed in the 1980s to prevent aircraft from running into each other. Last August, Italian researcher Giacomo Longo presented a paper at a conference in Philadelphia in which he described how his team had patched together hardware and written software that could produce spoofed TCAS alerts at distances up to 4.2 kilometers, or roughly 2.6 miles away. These could cause planes to veer suddenly off course. In January, the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency issued an alert about the vulnerability. On January 29th, an American Airlines jet carrying 64 people collided with an Army Black Hawk helicopter as it was coming in to land at Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport. The plane's TCAS had given the flight crew an audible traffic advisory about the collision 19 seconds before the crash, but further audible warnings were suppressed by design. As the plane descended below a standard advisory cutoff altitude, the ensuing collision killed everyone aboard the jet and all three crew members on the Black Hawk. About a month later, on March 1st, at least a dozen planes landing at the airport reported that they were getting false TCAS warnings with no aircraft in sight. It's been happening all morning. No one else has been seeing anything except for on the TCAS, an air traffic controller told One Aircraft. Three planes aborted their landings and conducted go-around maneuvers. I've never heard of something like this, former National Transportation Safety Board Chairman Robert Sumwalt told CBS. Nuisance alerts, yes, they happen, but not like this, where several planes have it at the same location. 5 days later, more anomalies occurred. Several flight crews arriving and departing Reagan Washington National Airport received onboard alerts Thursday morning indicating another aircraft was nearby, although no other aircraft were in the area, the FAA tells Vanity Fair. Within the world of aviation cybersecurity, the ghost alerts were widely regarded as suspicious, as no one could think of how the signals involved could have been produced innocently or inadvertently. I find the events suspiciously compatible with the exploits outlined in my paper, Longo tells Vanity Fair, adding that a spoofing attack is the most plausible explanation for the observed anomalies. It seemed to him that someone has been using what I built for harm, and I don't like it one bit. The story took a dramatic twist on March 27th when Senator Ted Cruz stated at a Senate hearing, "It's now come to my attention that these warnings were caused by the Secret Service and the U.S. Navy improperly testing counter-drone technology at Reagan." Cruz claimed that the government test had used the same spectrum band as TCAS, causing interference and faulty resolution advisories. Even though the FAA had reportedly previously warned the Navy and the Secret Service against using that specific spectrum band due to interference risk. Is Cruz correct? I've never heard of spoofing TCAS as a counter-drone tactic before, says John Wiseman, an independent aviation researcher who investigates unusual aviation incidents using publicly available data. He points out that while some drones are outfitted with TCAS, an unmanned vehicle penetrating hostile airspace would not likely be deterred by a TCAS alert. Wiseman also is skeptical of the claim that the ghost alerts were triggered by interference in the frequency band. For a TCAS system to generate an alert, it needs to receive multiple correctly encoded digital messages received at just the right time. It's unlikely that this could happen by accident. It seems like it has to be intentional, not just the result of jamming, he says. Even if the anomalies resulted from a well-intentioned research project, the way that the testing was carried out seems strangely unprofessional. When researchers like Longo and Humphreys build their experimental rigs, they are careful to do so in shielded environments so that their signals won't leak and cause mayhem in the real world. Such precautions would seem especially urgent less than a month after the first fatal commercial mid-air crash in over a decade, along a flight path that passes just 1 mile from the White House. What a weird place and time to do that sort of testing, Wiseman marvels. A spokesperson for the Secret Service denies Cruz's allegations, telling Vanity Fair that it did not conduct any drone system testing in the National Capital Region on March 1, 2025. The agency has been coordinating with the FAA to ensure our systems do not interfere with FAA frequencies or commercial air traffic operations. A representative for the Navy tells Vanity Fair it is looking into the matter. Regardless of who is actually responsible for the ghost alerts and whether the motive behind them was benign or malicious, the incidents appear to mark an historic turning point in the annals of U.S. aviation. The first time that a deliberate, sophisticated spoof has disrupted commercial airliners in the national airspace. Once there has been one, there will in all likelihood be more. Whether they occur in an environment that is complacent and vulnerable, or alert and adaptive, depends on how we react now. Until now, the threat that airliners could be hacked has been abstract and remote feeling. It's hard to rally vigilance for a threat that has never manifested before. But all that's changed. In a criminal court, a defendant is presumed innocent until proven otherwise. That standard of proof can't apply in an adverse security environment, where attackers can strike in unforeseeable ways, the evidence itself is prone to be altered, and the stakes are human lives. When you suspect that sophisticated adversaries are intent on doing you harm, it's irresponsible to wait for definitive proof you've been attacked. Sometimes, you just have to expect the worst. Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McCamus. Bernadette Peters, the Broadway legend, talks high-maintenance dogs, Chinese philosophy, and her love for Stephen Sondheim. What is your idea of perfect happiness? A peaceful, joyous time in the world, or in my head? Which historical figure do you most identify with? Well, not identify as such, but I love his quotes, Lao Tzu. Here's one. He who knows that enough is enough will always have enough. Which living person do you most admire? I most admire Steve Sondheim, who is not alive anymore, but his words and music keep him alive. What is the trait you most deplore in others? People's need to feel superior to others. All it does is cause judgment and hate. What is your greatest extravagance? Taking care of the two beautiful souls who are my dogs, which I don't consider an extravagance at all. What is your favorite journey? Traveling to Africa on safari. You can't imagine just how amazing it is. And then going to Rwanda to visit the gorillas. They say hi, by the way. What or who is the greatest love of your life? Top of the list is my husband, Tom. Then, of course, Charlie. You know who you are, woof. Which talent would you most like to have? I would love to be able to play the piano really, really well. Can you imagine sitting down and filling a room with Mozart or Beethoven? If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? One of Bernadette Peters' dogs, of course. They live the best lives ever. I'm telling you, you should all sign up. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? When you have no love or compassion left for yourself, terrible things happen. When and where were you happiest? I have a lot to be grateful for, but right now, being married, having time to be with my husband and his children, I feel very grateful. Who are your heroes in real life? People who decide to make a difference and do something to change things when help is needed. Like the man who built Broadway Cares, Equity Fights AIDS, Tom Viola. What do you most value in your friends? Honesty, trustworthiness, and a deep understanding of emotions. Who are your favorite writers? I love Elizabeth Strout. Her characters all intertwine. You don't have to read all of her books, but I do. I'm always looking for the next one. What is your favorite occupation? I'm so lucky I'm doing it. What a privilege. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Bernadette Peters. Roman Empire. Joe Anoa'i slammed his way to WWE stardom as Roman Reigns. Now the brawny brawler is looking to Hollywood for his next starring role by Tom Clute. With photographs by Nick Riley Bentham, styled by Moses Moreno. Opening photo, the wrestler, Joe Anoa'i, photographed in Hollywood, Florida. About an hour into our flight, Joe Anoa'i tells me a secret. Roman Reigns isn't going to win the Royal Rumble. As far as spoilers go, this is akin to finding out who was getting whacked on The Sopranos the night before an episode aired, and if James Gandolfini was tipping you off. Anoa'i, after all, knows Reigns the same way Gandolfini knew Tony Soprano, or like Terry Bollea knows Hulk Hogan. Since 2012, Anoa'i has performed as Roman Reigns in the great American soap opera that is World Wrestling Entertainment. He has sculpted the character, tinkered with his look and mannerisms, ultimately transforming Reigns from an awkward babyface, good guy, to a commanding heel, bad guy. I'm very passionate about being a storyteller, being able to dive into a character and wear a different skin, Anoa'i says. That's the beauty of wrestling and what we do every single week. I can become this Roman Reigns guy. They aren't the same guy. Not entirely, anyway. Anoa'i is laid back, a self-described introvert who says he's most comfortable as part of a team. Reigns is domineering and megalomaniacal, qualities that he channels in his two-word catchphrase, acknowledge me. Anoa'i is a father of five who performs morning drop-off duty. Reigns is known as the tribal chief, a mob-style boss who rules over his family with an iron fist. But in professional wrestling, the best characters are often amplified versions of the performer. We just turn the dial up, he says. My normal level is a five or a four, but when it's time to work, we turn it up to a 10 or an 11. At this moment, somewhere above the southeastern United States, Reigns is nowhere to be found. It's just Anoa'i and an entourage that includes his on- and off-screen collaborator Paul Heyman. We're heading to Indianapolis for the Royal Rumble, one of WWE's tentpole events. The winner of the Rumble traditionally gets a title shot at WrestleMania, WWE's equivalent of the Super Bowl, which for Reigns would mean yet another match against Cody Rhodes. They squared off at the previous two Manias, with Reigns losing the undisputed WWE Universal Champion title in last year's main event. Three in a row seems a bit much, Anoa'i admits. To keep different trajectories right now between Cody and I, keep us a little bit separate, isn't a bad thing. Anoa'i can stomach a loss as long as the best storyline wins. And, like any member of an ensemble, he knows that even the star must occasionally step to the periphery in order to make way for other characters and arcs. We have a nice cast of guys and superstars who can fill that role, he says. Reigns has been the unquestioned headliner of that cast, holding the Universal Championship for 3.5 years and appearing in a record 9 main events at WrestleMania. Those credentials have also made Reigns the face of WWE, a designation once bestowed upon the likes of Stone Cold Steve Austin, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, and John Cena. What distinguishes Reigns is that he has been the marquee draw during the company's most prosperous era. In 2023, WWE was acquired by Endeavor and merged with the Dana White-led Ultimate Fight Championship, UFC, forming a publicly traded company called TKO Group Holdings. that reportedly has a market cap of around $24.3 billion. Meanwhile, WWE's flagship weekly program, Raw, is now on Netflix as part of a $5 billion deal inked last year, making it just a click away from the likes of Stranger Things and Squid Game. Beyond pop culture, WWE's sphere of influence has extended to politics, never more so than in our current epoch. Donald Trump himself was inducted in WWE's Hall of Fame for his memorable cameo at WrestleMania in 2007, where he participated in the Battle of the Billionaires against Vince McMahon, the charismatic former WWE boss, whose rise and fall was chronicled last year in a six-part Netflix documentary. Linda McMahon, Vince's wife, served in Trump's first administration and has been appointed Secretary of Education. The couple are now separated. WWE's clout is such that someone like Anoa'i could conceivably land in Washington or Hollywood, following the likes of Cena and Johnson from the ring to the silver screen. He had a small part in Hobbs and Shaw, the 2019 Fast and Furious spinoff starring Johnson and Jason Statham, and in The Pickup, a forthcoming heist comedy, Anoa'i will appear in a scene with Eddie Murphy and Kiki Palmer. He probably shows as much charisma that I've ever seen from a celebrity or non-actor, says Tim Story, who directed The Pickup. I think his future in front of the camera will be ridiculous. Anoa'i will turn 40 in May, as evidenced by the faint streaks of gray and his long dark hair and beard. He is wary of his bump card, the number of knocks a wrestler absorbs before he can no longer step in the ring. There are, it seems, only so many times a guy can take a metal chair to the back. Anoa'i's current deal with WWE expires after WrestleMania next year, and he admits that he is closer to the end than the beginning. After I finish the contract that I'm in, we probably got another year or two max, he says. Then it's time to take on a less physical form of entertainment. Hours before we depart for Indianapolis, Anoa'i is in his personal gym for a pre-flight workout. He says he'll keep it light this afternoon, just enough to give him a nice pump before the following night's match, where he will go shirtless before a television audience of millions. As Anoa'i tells it, the quality of his physique can be gauged by the amount of clothing he's wearing. You can go through my history and see when I was in good shape or when I was covered up, he says. Of course, what Anoa'i considers bad shape would be aspirational for most of us, and what he describes as a light workout spans 3 hours, leaving his black Jordan brand T-shirt drenched in sweat. He and his trainer, Miguel Molina, take turns using various machines and dumbbells in a fully stocked gym located in the backyard of Anoa'i's Miami-area mansion, which sits in a gated community that includes entertainers and professional athletes. Molina works with various NBA and NFL players, but Anoa'i is the rare client who is actually stronger. I'm trying to keep up with him, Molina says. Anoa'i's intense fitness regimen, working out 5 to 6 days a week, and adhering to a strict meal plan is necessary to maintain his Adonis-like build. But he says it is also about giving him a sense of control, something today's travel schedule threatens to rupture. This flight will kind of F shit up a bit and make me hold a little bit of water, he explains. That won't do. If his look isn't right, then his performance will suffer. And if his performance suffers, well, you get the idea. Anoa'i is a homebody, living with his wife Galena and their 5 children, 2 sets of twin boys, ages 5 and 8, and a daughter, who will be a senior in high school in the fall. My kids used to think I just work out for a living, Anoa'i says. After the workout, both sets of twins wander into the gym, aimlessly exploring the equipment. As Anoa'i looks on, he predicts that at least one of the boys will follow his path to WWE. They're going to be nurtured to think like, well, everybody's just living a wrestling life, he says. That's what you're supposed to do, just train and eat. For Anoa'i, wrestling is as much a birthright as a family business. Dubbed the Samoan Dynasty, the Anoa'i clan is widely considered pro wrestling's greatest family, although not every member is related biologically. High Chief Peter Maivia, who was the grandfather of Johnson, or The Rock, is considered the patriarch of the family. Maivia forged the connection with the family by taking a blood oath with Anoa'i's grandfather, Reverend Amituania Anoa'i. His father, Sika, formed a tag team duo with his uncle, Afa, known as the Wild Samoans, that rose to prominence in the 1980s. Sika and Afa passed away within 2 months of each other last summer. His brother Matt, who died unexpectedly in 2017, had performed in WWE under the name Rosie. Growing up in Pensacola, Florida, Anoa'i was nearly inseparable from his twin cousins, Joshua and Jonathan Fatu, who now perform in WWE as Jay and Jimmy Uso. Their father, Solofa Fatu, performed in WWE for years as Rikishi. Anoa'i's parents separated when he was young, and while he lived with his superhero mother, Patricia, he recalls bonding with his father over wrestling. They followed the Monday Night Wars between WWE, then known as WWF, and World Championship Wrestling, and would quiz each other about the matches. It was also an education for Sika, who was watching the wrestling business change in real time. Back then, WWE was pivoting toward more adult-oriented programming as it entered what is known as the Attitude Era, a far cry from the more campy heyday of the Wild Samoans. For a time, the gridiron rather than the ring looked like Anoa'i's gateway. He was a standout high school football player and earned a scholarship to Georgia Tech, where he was teammates with future NFL Hall of Fame receiver Calvin Johnson. He starred on the defensive line at Tech, being selected as a team captain and earning first-team All-Atlantic Coast Conference honors his senior year. It was there where he met Galena, who was a member of the school's track and field team. Anoa'i gave the NFL a go, first attending a rookie minicamp with the Minnesota Vikings as an undrafted free agent in 2007. The experience was both brief and traumatic. After Anoa'i's physical, team trainers spotted something amiss with his blood work that turned out to be chronic myeloid leukemia. "It was the biggest mental F that I've ever had in my life," he recalls. The diagnosis brought Anoa'i's time with the Vikings to an abrupt end as he began a period of oral chemotherapy. After the disease was treated, Anoa'i signed up with the Jacksonville Jaguars at the tail end of training camp, ultimately getting released in the team's final round of cuts. He spent a season in the Canadian Football League with the Edmonton Eskimos before being released. By then, Anoa'i and his wife had welcomed their daughter, and the newly minted dad needed a job. He returned to Pensacola and worked for his older sister Vanessa's office furniture installation company alongside his twin cousins. The three spent their days assembling task chairs and their nights closing down a local bar. "That was the bit of normalcy I needed to teach me. This isn't what I want," he says. A visit from his dad to the warehouse proved clarifying. As Anoa'i put together an office chair, Sika looked on with bemusement. "He just told me in a very condescending, belittling way, 'How long are you going to build your sister's chairs?'" recalls Anoa'i, who responded with a well-executed reversal. "I said, 'Well, I guess I'll be doing this until you teach me how to wrestle.'" Sika beamed. Then he made some calls. Soon, Anoa'i was off to Tampa, where he began his tutelage at Florida Championship Wrestling, WWE's developmental promotion that has since been rebranded as NXT. Debuting under the name Leaky, Anoa'i was almost immediately pegged for stardom. Paul Levesque, WWE's chief content officer, who was then overseeing the developmental territory, left a meeting with Anoa'i, convinced that he had found the next face of the company. Levesque turned to Dusty Rhodes, the late father of Cody, who was training Anoa'i at FCW, and laid down a marker. "I remember walking out to Dusty and saying, 'God, if that effing Leaky kid is not a top guy here in 10 years, I don't know what the F we're doing,'" says Levesque, who is perhaps better known by his ring name Triple H. "It's not just a look, it's an intangible factor," he adds. "I get to ask this all the time when we do tryouts. What is it we're looking for? I'm looking for that." The American flag that flies above WWE's headquarters in Stamford, Connecticut, is 76 feet wide and 40 feet tall. It was raised there just before Veterans Day in 2023. Because, as Vince McMahon put it at that time, not too many flags fly these days. McMahon's claim that it is one of the largest flags in the country also seems like a stretch, given that it's the same type of oversized Old Glory found at car dealership lots across the country. But then McMahon was always known for puffery, which might have been the least of his sins. The longtime WWE patriarch has been gone from the company for more than a year now, following a lawsuit from a former employee, Janelle Grant, who accused McMahon of sexual assault and trafficking, as well as physical and emotional abuse. McMahon has denied the allegations. His attorney did not respond to a request for comment. McMahon had survived lawsuits and scandals before. In 2022, following allegations that he made hush money payments to former employees to conceal alleged sexual misconduct, McMahon retired as CEO of WWE. But he returned 6 months later, in January 2023, as a board member in an effort to engineer a sale of the company, ultimately leading to WWE's merger with UFC. McMahon was tapped to serve as executive chairman of the conglomerate, but with new stakeholders and board members to answer to, he no longer had impunity. That became clear on January 26, 2024, when McMahon resigned from his role at TKO 1 day after Grant's lawsuit was filed. McMahon agreed to pay $1.7 million to settle SEC charges in January after failing to disclose 2 alleged hush money payments. In a statement at the time, McMahon characterized the payments as minor accounting errors with regard to some personal payments. Anoa'i tells me that the allegations from Grant are a stain on WWE. She's got to live with all these situations that happened, and hopefully she's in a place where she feels comfortable and she's secure in her own place, he says of Grant. It's embarrassing. That's stuff you don't want to hear about. You don't want your family to hear about. Anoa'i says McMahon reached out last year to wish him a happy birthday, but the former CEO and chairman has, by all accounts, completely removed himself from WWE affairs. Last spring, he sold the last of his remaining shares in TKO Group Holdings. But McMahon's legacy still looms over the company. He built WWE into a juggernaut by tapping into the power of television, bringing wrestling to a national audience in the 1980s with Saturday night's main event on NBC. The company evolved with the medium, launching its own over-the-top network in 2014 before phasing it out and migrating its content to the NBC-owned streamer Peacock in 2021. McMahon's legacy is also evident in WWE stars such as Roman Reigns. The company's consistent ability to refill its talent pool and tailor its programming to multiple generations is reminiscent of another institution of American television, Saturday Night Live. Roman Reigns is a massive star and completely unique. We often say at WWE that the next star never looks like the last star. As John Cena winds down his career, it has been great to see our current perennial WrestleMania main eventer Roman Reigns look, sound, and act in a completely different way than anyone you have seen previously at WWE, says Nick Khan, the president of WWE. McMahon's eye for talent eventually landed on Anoa'i, who was elevated from FCW to WWE's main roster in 2012. Reigns was originally part of a faction known as the Shield, which included the wrestlers Seth Rollins and Dean Ambrose. The trio was well received by fans, but it was clear that Reigns was the one being fast-tracked to the main event tier. By 2014, the Shield disbanded and Reigns embarked on a singles career. He was presented as a babyface who called himself the Big Dog, but the audience booed him as if he were a heel. WWE fans can be ruthless and unforgiving, especially to a performer they believe is being foisted upon them by the company. They're an educated fan base, and they're just not going to have someone who's not 100% ready pushed onto them because those flaws are apparent. They were able to see the holes in my game, the inexperience that was still lingering over me, Anoa'i says. It was very simple. They were honest, and I wasn't. In 2018, Reigns appeared on Raw and introduced himself by his real name, revealing to the crowd that his leukemia had returned. The announcement led to an outpouring of support for Anoa'i, but it didn't put Reigns completely over with fans. I thought, okay, you really can't boo a guy who came back from leukemia, and there's going to be sympathy, says Dave Meltzer, a journalist who has been covering pro wrestling for more than 50 years. There was sympathy, but it didn't have the reaction that I thought. It kind of told me the fan base doesn't care about the person, but they sure care about the character. The breakthrough for Anoa'i and his character came during the pandemic. While the NBA and other leagues suspended their seasons, WWE plowed ahead, broadcasting from its empty training facility in Orlando. Anoa'i, however, initially stayed home due to his immunocompromised status. He even considered hanging it up over his frustrations with the character. I was prepared to walk away if we weren't going to be able to do what I felt was right for me creatively at the time, he says. McMahon went to Anoa'i with a proposal. What would he think about teaming up with Paul Heyman? A cinephile with a Hitchcockian look, Heyman has worn just about every hat in the wrestling business. He was the owner of a renegade promotion called Extreme Championship Wrestling and a commentator for WWE, while also serving as on-screen manager for a host of different wrestlers. Behind the scenes, Heyman is known as a sounding board for WWE talent and executives alike, drawing from his repository of pop culture knowledge to help develop characters and storylines. If pro wrestling is an art form, and it is, then Heyman is an auteur, willing to do whatever it takes to summon the best performance. If you want me to play Scorsese to your De Niro or DiCaprio, if you want me to be David Chase to your Gandolfini, I'm going to have to say things to you and find vulnerability and sensitivity and trigger points in you that no other human being on the face of this planet would dare explore. Heyman recalls telling Anoa'i, not your wife, not your parents, not your children. Heyman and Anoa'i gave Reigns an edge. They changed the character's look, ditching the blue contact lenses and swapping out the black vest for a wardrobe of athleisure and leaned into the wrestler's lineage, creating a sinister stable known as the Bloodline that included Jay and Jimmy Uso. Heyman, meanwhile, was introduced as Reigns' obsequious on-screen manager who goes by the Wise Man. When the new Roman Reigns returned as a heel in August 2020, wrestling fans were finally ready to embrace him. The big dog was put down. In his place came the tribal chief. Reigns had, seemingly overnight, become WWE's most compelling character. Just as the company was about to go through its own radical transformation, and as the tribal chief drove some of the richest storylines on WWE's weekly morality play, its business experienced its most lucrative period ever. Anoa'i doesn't think that's a coincidence, and he believes he deserves credit for being a reliable headliner amid all the upheaval at the company and through the COVID pandemic. To put it another way, Anoa'i is ready for you to acknowledge him. I was the top guy. The business did all that it did, and I was the one that was the marquee of it all, he says. Soon, WWE will have to turn to a new top guy to put people in the seats as Anoa'i begins to eye his post-WWE career. It is not difficult to envision Anoa'i, who is jacked and bears a resemblance to Jason Momoa, carving out a movie career as an action star or superhero. He's a physical specimen, says David Leitch, the director of Hobbs and Shaw, who is reportedly in talks to direct Ocean's 14 with George Clooney and Brad Pitt. The camera loves him, the audience loves him, and the only thing standing in his way is his own ambition. Anoa'i receives a lot of scripts, but his WWE responsibilities have precluded him from taking many roles. When the time comes for him to fully pursue acting, Anoa'i plans on being selective. I almost want to model it after Tarantino, where we're not just doing anything. Anything and everything. I want to really plot out, I want this one, I want that one, Anoa'i says. As our flight makes its descent for Indianapolis, I make the half-serious suggestion that he might someday run for governor of Florida. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.